jazz.
Busted.
Well, are you ready to get in the deep end already?
Sure. No.
We got our life preservers on, people. We're going to need them today. Welcome to Jazz Bastard Podcast 174. I'm Pat.
I'm Mike.
And we're going to take on three fairly challenging works in this podcast. I think it was inspired by Mike's very kind gift to me of Wayne Shorter's Eminon, 2018 release, that I got to admit I kind of put off buying, in part because it's expensive and in part because, well, we'll talk about Wayne's later work. His career's gone through many phases. And then he suggested doing Ingrid Lodbrok, is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Well, you had said third streamy, so...
Right.
Yeah.
So, anyway, she released an album also in 2018 called Contemporary Chaos Practices, and that involved a large ensemble as well. One of the three discs of Wayne Shorter's album includes the Orpheus Chamber Orchestra along with his quartet. And then finally, as a complete ringer, but another kind of odd semi-third streamy thing, I pulled out a George Russell LP. The listener won't have to hear much of this, but man, I'm in Phlegm City.
My eardrums shatter at some point during the podcast.
I'm sorry. I had a week's vacation, and it was great the whole time. Had a fantastic time in Hayward, Minneapolis, and then coming back Sunday, 10-hour drive, I got sick. And I've been sick all week, but I had to go to work because I'd just taken a week vacation, so there you go. Anyway, George Russell's Othello Ballet Suite. Her suite. God. Man, dude, you may just have to carry the load here.
Oh, no. Wayne Shorter is your street. Yeah.
Let me try for a 15th time.
That's all right. Othello Ballet Suite, parts 1 and 2, along with Electronic Organ Sonata number 1.
Yes. George spends 14 minutes on his organ. We don't know why. We'll get into that. And maybe, unless you've got a preference, I thought we'd start with George and then
let's do the recent stuff. Yeah, let's do George, then Ingrid, and then close with Wayne. I think that makes sense.
I thought we had not done George Russell before, but I was wrong. Back on episode 51, we talked about his album Stratus Funk. And that was from that excellent run of albums he had from the late 50s to the mid 60s. He made a group of records, and especially the ones with the sextet are excellent. I'd plump for Jazz Workshop and Aesthetic as the very best of those, but really all of them are fairly good. He does a couple of big band albums in that period, which aren't quite as successful, but really anything from there is good. And then his career continues. He gets more interested in electronics, but I don't think he's ever got a run after that that's quite as condensed and as, uniformly excellent.
The period in the 60s, so he has that great run in the late 50s, early 60s, and then he, like a lot of folks, gets tired of racism in America, and so he goes to Europe. And he works with a bunch of European people who will soon be European jazz gods, sort of go through his little group, including some people we'll talk about today, but Arne Domnarus and Bernd Rosengren and Jan Garbarek and John Christensen, among others. So he kind of works with the whole Scandinavian jazz luminaries in the 60s, and those albums are pretty good. He doesn't have Dolphy floating around the group anymore, but the stuff that he puts out in the 60s, I kind of like during that sojourn in Europe. And then he comes back to the States. One of the Schulers, I think, invites him to teach at one of those New England schools.
Ah, okay.
And he goes back, and then he does a lot of work on commission. So he gets commissioned jazz/classical pieces, and he kind of makes a living that way. But a pretty interesting dude throughout his whole career. And I want you to give the class a little mini lecture to start off with before we talk about George. I did a little reading just to kind of brush up and understand. It would be cool if you could talk about, like, the Lydian mode, L-Y-D-I-A-N, and what that means for jazz music for people like George Russell, because this is what he's kind of famous for.
What Mike's referring to is that Russell is probably best known in jazz circles, really, as a theorist who wrote the Lydian chromatic concept of tonal organization. And it's one of the major kind of theory books about jazz and how to improvise. It's, you know, fairly influential, and, you know, this comes out in 1953, and around that time, he appears, I believe, on an album kind of organized by Gunther Schuller that may well have been called Third Stream. I'm not absolutely sure. I've got it in my collection, but I can't pull it out right now. And his composition appears on it called All About Rosie. And I think J.J. Johnson's got something there. And I think Miles Davis appears maybe on the J.J. Johnson number. I can't keep it all straight in my head. So he's kind of known as a leading light, not in pure avant-garde atonal music, but in kind of advanced modal playing. And the Lydian, I cannot remember exactly what scale it is. There are various scales or modes. So I'm not going to go into detail about it because I don't understand it all, but he is the one that kind of codifies this. And I believe, I don't want to go on trial for this, that he is one of the origins of this idea that when you're improvising on a harmonic framework, a series of chords that underlie a well-known song, whether it's I Got Rhythm or the Blues or a Cole Porter tune, instead of just looking at the chords, the three or four notes that make up the harmonies beneath the song, instead of thinking about playing on those, you could think about playing with scales. And I believe he's kind of the, you know, one of the fountainheads of this idea that think of scales rather than chords, and what the rules would be, what scales you could use in a given bar or two beats or four bars or whatever, however long the harmony lasts. That's about as much as I know about it.
That's okay. That's good. I mean, that helps. So the kind of improvisation that one gets up to then starts to get a lot more mathy and a lot more abstract and even almost classical in a way, as opposed to just Sonny Rollins running changes on a chord.
Right, though Sonny himself was willing to push the boundaries in a way that I don't, you know, Sonny, let's say Sonny's dead. Okay, because we know Sonny.
We'll pick a different Sonny, yeah.
He colors within the lines, very much so. A brilliant player, but you know.
Right.
And, you know, it's weird because I've never read this book. It's probably just going to remain over my head till I die. I haven't studied that much theory. But what's interesting is even though he's best known for this, and, you know, he's not a fantastic keyboard player or something, he turns out to be, as a theorist, what you might not suspect, a really good band leader who makes really listenable, enjoyable records rather than somebody who is great with pen and paper, but in the world of practice doesn't necessarily succeed. We tend to think of theoreticians versus practitioners. I like his albums, as I said before, a lot from, you know, this earlier, you know, first, say, decade and a half of his career. And I don't hate the other ones, but I mean, those I just think are really, as small group jazz goes, both enjoyable on a challenging level of, you know, the rhythms and the cross lines and the writing is pretty intricate in a way that Gil Evans was, you know, he doesn't sound like Gil Evans, but they wrote a lot early in their careers. And then later they both kind of moved towards more open structures, less written out stuff, more focus on soloists, more focus on simpler environments. So yeah, he's good at both those things, but I've mainly experienced him as a leader and like that stuff.
Right. Cool. Well, that's super, super helpful. So yeah, this disc we're going to talk about, or this date we're going to talk about, it's really two sessions kind of plonked together, during his European sojourn. And it's the personnel listed is not the personnel you hear. That is to say, a lot more people are playing here than,
right,
the names. So the names are the ones I already name checked already on Dom de Roos on alto, John Christensen on drums, Bernt Rosengren, and Jan Garbarek. I don't know if you say Jan or Jen. I'm going to go with Jan because he's Norwegian. So,
okay.
On tenor. And all of these people who moved in the Scando jazz circles, this is like an ECM roster. Like, you know,
an embryo, right? Yes, he's growing
exactly,
up for him.
You know, John Christensen and Garbarek play on a shit ton of ECM releases. Christensen is one of the go-to percussionists for those sessions. But before they got smoothed out in the ECM mixer, they were working with Russell doing other stuff. So yeah, the Othello Ballet Suite, and I don't know anything about it, but I'm gonna assume it was a commissioned work by somebody because it does sound like you could dance to it. I've seen a fair amount of contemporary ballet I could totally picture this being accompanying music for a performance. I had no problems wrapping my head around that. And that was recorded in November of 67, I guess. And then the Electronic Organ Sonata Number 1. Which is, you know, the most frightening thing about that title is it implies there was a number two.
There will be more. Brace yourselves, people.
That's recorded in October of 68, and they kind of all get thrown together here on this particular disc. I'm going to say something controversial right off the bat. I probably derive more moment-by-moment pleasure from listening to the two parts of the Othello Ballet Suite than I do the Wayne Shorter discs. That is going to seem like sacrilege, you know, since at this point in his career, Wayne is, you know, a great eminence. He's 85. He's incredibly important. He's one of the great lions of the music. But just in terms of just, am I enjoying myself right now, moment by moment? And this is leaving out the electronic organ sonata. Moment by moment, I really like the Othello Ballet Suite. I think it's absolutely terrific. It really breaks, you know, it's very much through composed. And yet there are a handful of moments with jazz content, if you will, right? So like in the first ballet suite, or part one, you know, we have all kinds of interesting little sonic cells. And they, you know, it goes on for 17 or 18 minutes, but it breaks into units. But there's a sort of, there's a section that runs about 90 seconds or so, starting at about minute 4:15. And that's got a really nice sax solo for about 90 seconds. And then it kind of fades out, you know, and that's improvisation over some of these rhythmic building blocks that he's got set up here. There's a fair amount of tight drum work here that often is accented with swelling vibes, bells, other percussion. There's a xylophone for sure in a couple of these. Sometimes vibes and a xylophone. Sure, I heard. This is very much through composed, and in that sense, it can feel classical, but not really. There are some nice units here that sound sort of urban and kind of funky. There tends to be a fair amount of space between the little sonic units. I counted in the first part, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, about 8 discrete sections, and there are a couple of times when a section would have one of his players doing something improvisational. So I would sort of write Jay-Z over that, you know, that's happening, you know. But for the most part, there's not a huge amount of improvisation. It's just like there's a few moments where, or a few passages where players, typically a horn player, one of the sax players, gets to do something improvisational over some of the building percussion or rhythm instrumentation happening below. In any event, I find the shifting kind of kaleidoscope of forces here pretty interesting, pretty compelling moment by moment. And I enjoy this. I kind of want to see someone choreograph a ballet to this.
Right, yeah.
I kind of want to see what it would look like to see movement, you know, paired with these different sonic units. So I like this. I think it's pretty cool. And the range of instrumentation is really large. So there's guitar here, there's flute here, there's tuba, there's some string orchestration, but it's not really a whole, there's some violin, but I don't know that there's a whole string section on many of the numbers. It's just like he's got a huge amount of tools at his, you know, that available to him. And he deploys them kind of as he wishes to create these interesting sonic structures that occasionally allow for some improvisational content to occur above them. I don't know that I'm giving a very good description of what, you know, a verbal description of what it sounds like to listen to this, but I found it charming and compelling and generally interesting. He tends, not always, but he tends to build, we get a fair amount of interplay that builds tension. And this happens in a fair number of the sonic units that comprise the two parts of the ballet suite. And I'm a sucker for that. I dig that. I always enjoy those kinds of moments. They never go on too long. The thing he reminded me most of, I actually went back and listened to it again this week just to kind of remind myself. But, you know, the guy who reminds me of him the most, you know, in contemporary music is D'Arcy James Arghue. Who kind of scores for a jazz band in a similar way. I think he's given to broader gestures and more jazz improvisational content than George Russell is given to here. But in general, that's kind of what's going on. And I dig it. I like it a lot. The Electronic Organ Sonata, I think the less said, the better. It is literally 13 minutes and 41 seconds of wankery. I mean,
yeah.
It's like a soundtrack for a really bad sci-fi film. It's just, or a bad, you know, a 70s era Doctor Who episode. It's just, I love George, but this is negligible. This is just fucking around. This is the kind of thing that Sun Ra would do, except he at least would have had some boiling percussion and some trippy, we're going back to Saturn, we're going back to Saturn. We had some vocals, you know?
There you go.
This is just, wankery. It's ridiculous.
Very much a make weight. You know, it's an LP and the ballet suite goes about 30 minutes. And so they tag on this 14 minute organ sonata and you get, you know, a relatively generous, you know, running time for an LP. Whereas I guess they thought it might've been run a bit short. But when I saw this at Torn Light Records in Cincinnati, it was something I never heard of before by him. And I like George. And it was in great shape, but my heart kind of sank when I saw that, because I'm like, I don't know, I hope the suite's interesting, but that doesn't sound good. That organ sonata thing, that sounds ominous to me. It's like, oh, yeah, it's pretty silly. I think it's harmless.
It's harmless. He's got an electronic, organ. He's like, well, let's see what we can do with this.
Right.
It's literally like, run tape. Let me just see, you know, and it. As through composed as the Othello Ballet Suite sounds, the Electronic Organ Sonata sounds absolutely improvised.
Right. Oh, absolutely. I mean, could he reproduce that? Was it written down somewhere? I mean, maybe, but boy, it sounds like he's just kind of.
Exactly. And, you know, good for him. He's got the right to do that. But I also have the right to call wankery when I hear it. And I'm going to call wankery on that one. I just, ugh.
Press skip.
Yeah, yes. And I had listened to this thing the whole way through at least four times. But seriously, when it came on, my brain just, you know, I went to other places. Whereas when the Ballet Suite is on, I'm engaged.
There you go.
Interested.
Yeah, you start thinking of, what's his name, saying it's an abyss.
Yeah.
The scar, Tom Baker, there he is. It's like, watch out for the macaroni-hatted aliens and watch out for the abyss.
Sorry, I once again have to be a Pat whisperer for the class. So Pat is referring to a very bad Tom Baker episode of Doctor Who in which...
You're being redundant there, but go on.
Right. So anyway, Tom Baker and one of his hopeless assistants comes across a giant chasm. And the assistant says, my God, what's that? And Tom Baker says, with all of the mellifluous portentousness he can muster with that wonderful plummy voice of his, an abyss.
I know. Anyway.
Yes. Obvious. It's an abyss.
Still the best Doctor Who, by far.
It is. It's still. But you're right. This is an abyss.
So, yeah, the personnel I ran across, and this is on this weird Flying Dutchman label, which I don't think has found a secure reissue home exactly. I mean, things kind of pop in and out of sight.
And I think you recorded a few of these European outings with them.
Yeah, well, I'd be very curious to hear some other ones. They also list Rolf Eriksson on trumpet, who's, again, yeah, a name I know. And then the Swedish Radio Symphony Orchestra. So right, that's where all that other stuff is coming from. And in a way, this is both a show that's talking a little bit about jazz meaning the third stream and maybe implied, but also it's about jazz musicians working with larger than usual forces.
Right.
Though only a third of the shorter album does that. All three of these projects put a jazz musician in charge of not a quartet, not even an octet, not even a big band, but an assembly of musicians that's closer to the size and number, at least, of a symphony.
Yeah. If memory serves, the Swedish Radio Symphony Orchestra is both a serious unit and also a unit that is comfortable both with jazz and classical experimentation. So They I seem to recall having a disc somewhere of I want to say Varese, recorded by them. So I mean they're cool with Pierre Boulez and weird stuff on the fringe of classical and jazz. So George Russell is kind of just a natural fit for that group. Rolf Eriksson actually came over and played with Mingus at one point. So okay, like a lot of those guys, he's like a lot of those European guys. He has serious jazz cachet on both sides of the puddle, as it were.
Yeah. I mean, again, a name that I don't know if I could tell you what sessions he was on, but it's like, I know that name. I've seen it at least. You know? Yeah. I thought this was, surprisingly, gratifyingly good for what is ultimately incidental music. It sounds nothing like, but reminds me a little bit in that way of, there's a couple soundtracks to The Connection. Fairly obscure pianist, Freddie Redd, did a jazz background, and various jazz musicians starred in it, including your favorite Jackie McLean. I believe Tina Brooks is in it.
Yeah. I've seen the film. It's a fantastic
movie. Oh, yeah, you talked about that, right. I was only aware of it before that as a stage play, and through, I think I've got two different soundtrack albums with Freddie Redd on it of music from The Connection, one on Blue Note and one on some other label. But those are a little bit more traditional hard bop songs. They just are kind of strung along. A strung out story of jazz musicians waiting for the man. This is more clearly, little units, as you say, and I'm assuming that those different units or incidents mapped onto different moments of the ballet. I've never seen it, but I'm assuming that's why the music's kind of episodic. But most of the episodes are pretty interesting. I love the beginning of part two when it's all of a sudden we're kind of in swinging 60s and an electric bass comes out. You hear that kind of almost harpsichord sound and you're like, oh my gosh, it's time for Girls in Cages and Behave and the rest of it. So it really goes through a lot of different moods. I think the soloists sound really engaged. They're very good. They're stimulated by the environment they're in. As you said, there's not a ton of it. And there's just a lot of colors and it's somewhat challenging. At times it gets out. I mean, this is not a safe recording to put on at a dinner party or something, but I don't think of it as being real abrasive or at least in my sound world, it's pretty much consistently pleasant at one level or another and stimulating. The less said about the electric organ, the better. George should keep it out of sight.
Yeah.
Not expose it to the light.
Electronic organ. So electronic. What is the difference between electric and electronic?
Well, it does sound, as you say, almost, and I don't, it was like maybe the engineers had treated it in some manner. Maybe there's some tape manipulation going on or music concrete. I wasn't absolutely sure from when I was reading the liners. It's a nice production. I mean, it's a heavy cardboard gatefold with a beautiful classic painting on it of a nude woman.
Mm.
And as I said, it was, you know, good condition and everything, and an artist that I liked. I would not put it in his top rank, but I like an awful lot of George's stuff in this period, and it is certainly of interest. The difficulty being that, yeah, I don't know that the electronics organ indulgence was, you know, of the same value. But if you need a monster movie soundtrack, you're good.
Yeah.
The aliens are here. They want our brains, or our women, or both. Look out. Yeah, I just, it's one of those things. It's like, and I guess in a sense, it to me is symptomatic that George is one of these artists I do not want to go to the realm of atonality and have complete abstraction. I mean, he's got a real gift for organization. He's not a mainstream player, but when he's on that edge there, I mean, he's like a little bit more rhythmically aggressive and just willing to be directly out Gil Evans, right? But
yeah.
And just a little bit more, you know, a little bit more driven, a little bit more humor in his music, maybe. It's hard to pinpoint it, but he writes charts of similar intricacy for the sextet. I was just, you know, listening to the Jazz Workshop, which is just a stunning album, and it's got a very young Bill Evans who really, you know, this is Bill Evans coming out of Tristano, aggressive,
yeah,
articulate, driving, fantastic solos by him. And, you know, I was reading, it's like, that is just a sextet. I mean, there's so many things going on, so much interest. He's just a really talented writer, and it's always enjoyable to hear him. And as a keyboardist, he doesn't get in his own way. You know, I never feel like he bogs down those sessions, but you're not listening to him as a soloist, right?
There's
fantastic trombone players. You get Eric Dolphy on one of them. Anyway, look him up if you've never listened to his stuff. I think you're going to find stuff you like if you're at all into things that are a little bit to the left of the mainstream. But this is by no means, you know, wild. Unlike, perhaps, our friend Ingrid.
Ingrid Laubrock, German tenor player.
And she came to what they say is New York, but I think of as Brooklyn.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and anyway, she's got a long history. This is on the Intact with a K record label. And they gave me a lovely, and you too, I assume, a digital folder with it. And it lists like 7 other albums she's done under her own leadership and like 5 other appearances she's made. So this is a well-documented young woman, and I believe she's played in Mary Halverson's.
I have Paradoxical Frog somewhere.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, you may know Ingrid from such groups as Paradoxical Frog and Anti-House.
Yeah.
I don't know her from those, but you might.
Right.
They're beyond. So you've heard Paradoxical Frog, so you're ahead of me. It's a great name.
She's Mary Halverson's a running buddy. And bizarrely, because I'm going to need your help on this, Mary Halverson is supposed to appear on this album.
Right, and again, it's contemporary.
Chris Davis, someone who she's played with before on piano, I believe in Paradoxical Frog, actually. And then, Nate Woolley on trumpet, along with an orchestra.
And Ingrid herself solos.
Yeah,
pretty extensively on soprano and tenor. I mean, she's also a player.
Where does Mary appear?
Well, the very beginning, right? You can hear her. She's doing Mary stuff at the start of the first part of the Contemporary Chaos Practices, just to name it again. Mary's are definitely there, but after that, and this is one of the many things we can discuss concerning this album, which is I don't want to get too deeply into it at the very start, but there's a sense of, I'm not quite sure I get the sense of a cast of characters quite. There's a lot of people. The French horns come in with some real balls to the wall stuff a couple times, you know, but I don't know how to put my finger on this. You know, I was thinking about this. I think there's a lot of moments of pleasure here. This is much more out and challenging than George. I feel like it's more third streamy. It sounds more like classical music.
It sounds like a classical music composition from beginning to end. Especially if you know her from, you know, like Living by Lanterns. You know, she's played on a lot of... Look, this is someone who studied with David Liebman, right?
But she was exposed as a relatively young woman to Anthony Braxton. Remember, don't expose your children to Braxton. Strange
or
things may happen.
So, you know, here's the thing. I find this interesting, okay? It's definitely interesting, but I don't find it particularly compelling. Not the way that I find the Russell compelling.
Right.
I'm interested in the stuff that's happening. I love writing for the brass here. It's particularly exciting, but it feels like a small chamber classical. Well, it's not small, but it has a small feel. It feels like chamber classical music that I would go to. So UCSD has a series they call Art Power. And, you know, they have all kinds of different groups. They have world music groups and they have strange dance collectives in. They do a lot of edgy stuff. This sounds like something they'd program. This sounds straight up Art Power's programming. It's right in their wheelhouse. Challenging, oblique, pseudo-classical stuff. Heavy on the art.
Yeah, the kind of thing the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra would not touch with a 10-foot pole. Right.
Right. Like... I mean, it is self-consciously arty.
Oh, yeah.
And that's, you know, that's fine. I find it interesting. I don't find it compelling, which is just to say that, you know, when I listen to it, if I bear down and pay close attention, I'm enjoying lots of different things that are happening, but it's not something that I turn to or want to turn to. Whereas I could listen to George Russell's Othello Ballet Suite just for the pleasure of it. And this simply doesn't give me that kind of moment by moment pleasure. This feels a little bit more like homework to me.
Yes, definitely.
And I mean, that's not to say that the playing isn't of an extraordinarily high caliber, but it's not toe tapping. It's hard to see, you know, I have this listed on the old, portable music listening device as jazz, but I'm not sure that's right.
Right.
I really feel like this is classical. This is modern classical music.
You've got to eat your arties, the breakfast of champions, you know?
Yeah, I like modern classical, you know? I listen to modern classical, but I'm not always bowled over by or, you know, emotionally moved by modern classical. I'm not moved by this, even though I appreciate the very high level of musicianship on offer here. It's just not, I don't feel like there's jazz content here that much. It's very, very through composed. When I say through composed, we mean like people are reading off a sheet. You know, it's not improvisation. It's things happen at a certain point, at a certain place in time, and people sit and then politely clap afterwards.
Well, and also that it's not cyclical. It's not a form that repeats itself like a folk song or a pop song. It just goes on and on and develops or doesn't develop. But, you know, it doesn't repeat. There's not that kind of folk structure to it. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, it is what the label describes, contemporary chaos practices. Right.
She didn't call it back at the Chicken Shack Part 2. In her defense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's not Jimmy Smith's prayer meeting. You know,
that's an album I would like to hear her appear on.
I would love to hear her on prayer meeting. That would be a blast. You know, because she's a really good player. I like her. But this is just not, this is never going to be a favorite of mine. It's not bad. It's just, I know, I appreciate it. But Lordy. It's work. Listening to it is, look, you know what? I name checked earlier, and I'll say it again, Edgard Varese, his music concrète, that stuff, you know, when you listen to it, it's a fucking chore. And you're like, this is really interesting. It's dead fascinating, but goddamn.
Yeah.
It's not, I'm not putting it on repeat to listen to it over and over and over again. It's fiber. And now I'm ready for some Twinkies because I've got all the fiber I need now. So this is highly fibrous.
Right.
Which is, you know, and again, I know her from other settings and I like her a lot. This is good, but it's not my cup of tea on repeat. Let's put it that way.
Well, and it's not just a matter of the fact that this is not tonal or real predictable harmonically. It's more about the structures, which, of course, she signals by calling this contemporary chaos practice. And she's apparently this performance involved two conductors, one who conducted the written out parts and one who engaged in what I believe is called conduction, where you're kind of trying to direct improvisation into some kind of flow with multiple people. And that's been a problem in jazz throughout its history, is how do you integrate writing, known things that repeat, if not within themselves, at least, you know, each performance would be roughly the same, with improvisation, creation on the fly. How do you, especially with larger forces, how do you make those things work together, or can you, or do you want to? And this is apparently an exploration of one method of doing so. But I got to agree with you that the results I don't find super emotionally engaging. If there is a structure here, if there's a way that a certain inevitability is going to kind of cluster around the fact that part one comes from before part two and that part one goes through a series of progressions, I have not found it. Because you can have very atonal music that nonetheless seems to take you on a journey that seems to somehow make sense within itself, or is borne along by energy with somebody like Albert Eiler. And this is neither of those things. And it probably isn't supposed to be. Again, maybe she's trying to avoid a feeling of structure. But at some point, you get to chaos. And then it's like, well, that's life, right? You know, we've got helping heapings of that out the door every day. So, you know, it depends on what you're looking for in music. If you need music to escape all structure, then it'll be great. If you're looking for more structure in music than you find in life, or that you like structure, you're not going to find it. But the playing is good. I think she's a fine reed player. Mary's contributions, which I wish there were more of, I think are interesting. But I felt like listening to this, that when you get this large ensemble of people somehow, and maybe it's just tradition, maybe it's just brainwashing. You know, when I go to a symphony, I rarely question, did Beethoven or Bruckner, whoever, need 90 people? They're not all playing at once, but it seems like the roles of those musicians all make sense. And there's a purpose for that particular ensemble being there. And it, you know, the kind of patterns of use, and with the main through line typically being the strings, you know, they're the ones that they're the main voice often of, you know, classical music. It kind of makes sense to me. The group, its existence, its necessity seems self-explanatory. And that may just be tradition. I don't know. Here, I don't know why these people are all needed or what they're doing. Or, you know, if Mary's going to be there at the beginning, why she never seems to come back. You know, I guess if you live purely by the moment, it's like Memento. Just forget what you heard a minute ago. Enjoy the minute you're getting now. You can get some pleasure out of this, but it doesn't seem to add up. And again, may not have been her intention. It may not have been what she's chasing for. It's just, as a listener, I kind of like that. And you certainly don't get any concessions where George will play with classical motifs, but he'll also have some, you know, kind of pop music pleasures and jazz pleasures in his suite. This is not about the tension between popular and art impulses or cyclical music versus through written. It's very much on the side of art. They're really, I don't feel much of the other side of the equation of, that's the way I think about jazz. It's not what jazz has to be. It's just what I like about much jazz. I don't feel that tension there. It's all seems to be third streamy.
Yep.
Any other thoughts about Ingrid?
Nope.
Okay.
But yeah, if you don't let this be your entry to Ingrid, there's other stuff by her that we like a lot better. She's an important young player, and we picked this because it fit with the kind of third streamy feel of the podcast, but it's not representative of what we take to be her best work. And we haven't listened to all of her stuff, but we've listened to things that we like by her a lot, and this is not one of those things.
Well, you know, it is a challenge because the skill set of the jazz musician doesn't necessarily map onto dealing with a large ensemble. You know,
it's
they're not exactly countered, but thinking fast on your feet, interacting with, you know, it's got to be a manageable group of people, or it's just, it is chaos. I mean, you can't know what the third violin's going to do. You can't respond to that if you've got five other violins between, you know, it just can't be. So, yeah, it's an interesting challenge. And really, even the text kind of played up this idea that, you know, she's taking on this. And I can understand the joy in just having those kind of forces marshaled and hearing the kinds of sounds you can create. So, you know, I'm sure it was fulfilling for her, but less so for us, maybe. Well, anyway, we're coming now to the Doorstopper, the coffee table book, the project that Blue Note put out for Wayne Shorter that I feel like, and I don't want to, I'm not trying to be snide or condescending, but was meant as a kind of capstone. I don't know if vanity project's fair, but the packaging of this is announcing its importance and a very real financial commitment on the part of Blue Note to celebrating Wayne Shorter, Eminon. You know, they really went all out. You could spend three figures and get it on vinyl with a book, or you could spend...
I was going to ask, with the CD, did the graphic... So this comes with a graphic novel.
It does.
Or it's meant to accompany with a graphic novel. So did that come with the CD set?
Oh, yeah. No, this came in a book. It's a smaller book because it's CDs rather than vinyl. But yeah, it's a good size. You know, it's about the size of a comic book, except, you know, an inch thick. And hardbound. And so, yeah, the beginning of it.
Did you read it?
You know, I read a little bit of it. And I got to tell you, buddy,
I've heard things. Tell me if the things I've heard are true.
Well, I'd have had to read more of it to tell you that. I don't know if watercolor or almost a pastel is the right way to describe the art style. It doesn't do much for me. The writing... It seems self-consciously juvenile and silly. I mean, pretentious. It's not fun, but I didn't like it. But I have always felt guilty in that I try to say I'm open to pop culture, blah, blah, blah. You know, my dad was very much a guy who's like into odd corners, you know, Little Nemo, Doc right. Savage. And, you know, I have enjoyed going to those worlds. I mean, obviously don't look to Little Nemo, the turn of the century cartoon for racial enlightenment people. It's not there, but... There's some cool imagination. But the comic book as an art form has just always fallen terribly flat for me. And I apologize. I know it's really culturally central to a lot of people. I just, for me personally, I love art. I love writing. And it just seems like neither of those callings get fulfilled in most comic books. So I did not.
Can you, from the limited amount that you looked at it, could you tell the class what the graphic novel, stop calling it a comic book.
I'm sorry. My apologies, sir.
Could you tell the class roughly what it's about? I've read what it's about, but I wanted to hear you say it.
Well, it's sci-fi dystopian, and Eminon is going to come and fight the powers of conformity. That's about as deep as I got.
And apparently it's he's going to do this across the multiverse. So
yeah.
Different incarnations of Eminon across the multiverse will arrive to tell people. The part that I read that was
I tried to read it.
I read someone who was carping about the and so I want to read it at some point. Next time I visit, you have to let me read it.
Oh, absolutely.
Someone was carping about how in one of the multiverses, Eminon announces, he enlightens people by taking out like a full page ad in a newspaper. It's funny.
All right. Way to go, dude.
In different parts of the multiverse, apparently print technology is still the single most effective way to reach the masses. And I could think of no single less effective way to reach the masses than taking out.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, Twitter, that well's kind of poison. So, you know, maybe. The quaint old-fashioned ways are best if you're actually trying to spread freedom instead of evil. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But I read someone bitching about that, and I thought, that's a pretty good bitch. That's pretty funny. Anyway.
Yeah. So. And so I guess my point is that Blue Note did not let you buy in with just the music or streaming, or, you know, it was just like, you've got to plunk down $80 or $100, something ridiculous. I mean, lots of money. It's a 3-disc set, which is interesting because the whole thing runs a hair over 2 hours, and the 2 discs of live music by the quartet could easily have fit on 1 disc.
Yep.
Now, I don't want to carp here, but again, there's a kind of bloatedness about it. This was not needed. I mean, it's fine. I don't think that, I'm not asking that Wayne produce more music for my pleasure. I'm just saying that, just for the sake of the environment, if nothing else, put it on 2 discs. You don't need a third. I mean, you might need a third LP, but you sure as hell don't need a third CD to hold this data. So why are you using one? It's just, it doesn't make sense. So his quartet, Wayne's got a multi-section career going all the way back to the early 60s. He makes a couple kind of, you know, so-so albums on VJ. Then he becomes the music director for Art Blakey and is on many of their albums, the Jazz Messenger albums on Blue Note. Then he goes to work for Miles Davis, his second great quintet, and he's kind of the musical director there. He writes the bulk of the compositions for that group on Columbia, of course. During the 60s, he releases 11 albums under his own name on Blue Note. Now, some of those did not come out at the time. They came out later, but they recorded him on 11 leader dates. And he writes compositions for all of these, sometimes every or almost every composition on the album. So you can imagine he's writing for Art, he's writing for Miles, he's writing for himself, all during, you know, this roughly 10-year span. Incredible productivity. I don't know if it's been matched by any other jazz composer. I'm sure he wrote many more tunes than the entire canon of Thelonious Monk in this time. And then he goes to Weather Report. Mike gets very sad. We talked about Weather Report back in episode 10, and he's with them for almost 15 years. And then as he leaves them, he releases 3 solo albums on Columbia in the mid-80s era, which are kind of in a fusion vein. They aren't identical to Weather Report, but that kind of language and instrumentation is still there. And I think some of the compositions on those are actually very interesting. But, if you know, there's like sometimes very obnoxious synthesized drum beats, and they sound very, very much of their time. So you have to kind of listen past that to hear the quality of what he's written. And then there's a great comeback, and Wayne comes back to the acoustic fold. Basically, the start of the turn of the century.
Yeah.
And he releases 3 albums on Verve, Footprints Live 2002, Allegria 2003, Beyond the Sound Barrier 2005, and then there's a hiatus, and then Without a Net on Blue Note 2013, and Eminon on Blue Note 2018. So after this comeback, he's not been nearly as prolific. He's worked with the same group throughout, and he's not written a whole lot of new compositions. You know, this is kind of, it's an interesting fourth or fifth or sixth act for him. And his group is, you know, they list him on tenor, but the overwhelming impression is of soprano. And
yep.
Then Brian Blades on drums, Danilo, all right, you say it. You're just going to make fun of me anyway.
Danilo Perez on piano and John Patitucci on bass.
Okay. And that quartet is, we can talk about that. So
they go back with him back to the Footprint days, don't they? So
right. They've been with him throughout the great acoustic comeback. That's been his group from 2002. And, you know, he's 85 now, born 1933. So in a way, you know, it's obviously amazing the energy he's got and the ability to put this project together at this time. And, you know, Blue Note was willing because, of course, he was so pivotal to their story in their salad days to kind of give him this, I don't know, celebration, you know.
It's like
fancy.
A victory. To me, it's a victory lap. This
right.
is a victory lap.
So you already mentioned, spoilers, that you don't like it quite as much as George Russell's stuff, much
nope.
lesser known work. So tell us a little bit about your take of Eminon.
Well, so the first thing is, disc one reminds me, and not in a good way, of Ornette Coleman's science fiction sessions.
And this is the one that's with an orchestra. The first
yeah.
disc is orchestra, the second two are live with quartet. Sorry, okay.
Right. Right. So Ornette Coleman famously recorded his, was it his quartet or was it just him?
Well, he did an album with an orchestra called Skies of America.
Maybe that's what I'm thinking
of. Because the science fiction sections were kind of semi-electric stuff, some of it abrasive, but the big kind of showpiece with him as a third stream.
Was Skies of America. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I happen to like.
Yeah, I do too.
I think it's pretty damn good. And it's even if I can't remember the fucking title, and it's sort of oblique and it preserves Ornette's character even while it situates him in an orchestral concept, and the tension between the two kind of works for me. I like that. This reminded me of the Ornette third string project, which I like a lot. And I don't like this as much. And I'm not quite sure why. Some of it is a soprano playing. Shorter is a great, great, great player. But, soprano is his second instrument as far as I'm concerned. And he gets up to some deliberately shrill and unpleasantly atonal stuff here at times. That doesn't give me pleasure. And the quartet, many critics have remarked on this, the quartet just disappears in the wash of the orchestra. The only one you can really hear with any regularity is Brian Blade, and that's just because of the tight snare work that he's doing in different places. And so I don't particularly like Disc One, in part because he's revisiting some compositions. He's revisiting old compositions, and there's nothing wrong with that. His longtime playing buddy, Herbie Hancock, constantly returns to Watermelon Man. It's like a song that he comes back to every 10 years and re-records, So there's nothing wrong with these kind of revisitations.
No, I think it's great, actually. I mean, the idea. Yeah.
Right. I much prefer the quartet on the live recordings of the quartet on Disc 2 and Disc 3. So just say that.
Can I jump in? I'm going to argue that part of what's going on, I don't know that the writing is fantastic, but at times the Orpheus Orchestra, which I think, is a good place, is out of tune.
Mm.
And it is just, it's not only, it's just badly recorded. This is a bad job of recording. I mean, there are times that the strings are one place sonically, and you can hear like an oboe line, and it just sounds like it's in a different recording that was patched in. It's a bad recording. It's not well engineered. And that muddies up what is already, perhaps not the best thought through project. And we've got to remember, he's 85. The soprano is a very demanding instrument because a tight, tiny embouchure of it is like, a baritone sax, if you move your jaw a quarter of an inch, nothing fucking much happens. If you're doing the soprano, you've just changed three notes. It's just, you have to be a lot more precise with what you're doing because everything is scaled down so much that the slightest change makes a fairly big pitch difference. I mean, the adjective I thought of was querulous. He's gotten to the point where it's kind of a grumpy, get off my lawn sound of the soprano. And my God, the guy's fucking 85. I don't want to I think he's an amazing player. You want to hear Wayne just kicking ass. He does it for decades. And he starts a little bit shaky technically. Some of the stuff in Art Blakey, he doesn't sound like a major player quite yet. I mean, a great composer. But, by the time you get to the Plug Nickel in Chicago, it's like, holy fuck, man. Everybody should listen to that those quintet live dates.
Yeah.
He's a fucking monster. But, that's in 65 or something. That was a while ago.
Years later, yeah.
I wasn't an embryo quite yet.
So I prefer discs 2 and 3 because I can hear the quartet better. This is also beyond popular. I don't think Wayne's playing on soprano is up to par on discs 2 and 3. There's a fair amount of squally, screechy, almost multiphonic stuff going on, but it doesn't feel like someone who's doing it in a controlled way. It feels like someone who's at the limit of what he can do on an instrument.
And we can definitely hear it right now bleeding through your...
Sorry.
It's piercing.
I'm listening to him, and it's like he's at the limits of kind of what he can do. There aren't a lot of like long through lines, you know. Everything sort of clusters.
Yeah, well, and those stabbing interjections, I mean, that was kind of his modus operandi from Weather Report forward to some degree.
Yeah.
That's the way he worked in Weather Report, it's just in better tune, yeah.
That, but you also felt like he could always do something else. And on the Live Weather Report albums, he does.
Oh, yeah, oh, of course, I mean, it's...
Right,
he's
I mean,
still...
so this feels like an 85-year-old man kind of at the limits of what he can do on the instrument, which isn't to knock what he was or what he has been. But honestly, there are people who want to talk about Lion in Winter and late music as a final efflorescence. This feels like someone, I don't know. I don't think it's that good. I don't think his playing is that good. I don't think he's as good as the other players in his quartet. And that's a horrible thing to say because it's fucking Wayne Shorter. But
well, but I'm going to argue, though, that the quartet themselves, I mean, I think they are all way more they're more technically secure than he is now, of course. I mean, they're middle-aged musicians who are all of a very high caliber. I don't know that they are, you know, these performances are sprawling.
Yeah.
I mean, almost like over 20 minutes.
27 minutes for the three Marias. 27 minutes.
Well, each of them needed a certain amount of space. You know, you're going to give one Maria 7 or 8 minutes and deny. I feel like, in a sense, they have looked back at the second great quintet and kind of walked away with, and maybe Wayne has, some of the wrong answers. In that, to me, part of the greatness of that group was ability to stretch things into it. Yes. And to go out, yes, but also to create moods, to make express emotion through music. And it wasn't the whole range of emotion. It tended to be melancholy or interest, you know, but there are just magic moments on those albums, the Great Quintet albums from the 60s on Columbia. They're a little bit opaque at first. You know, they did not win a wide audience at the time, but there was a commitment. And of course, after a couple years, the quintet at that time started to lose that focus and get a little bit more five players each thinking about what they wanted to do next rather than this amazing unit. And yeah, I feel like this group always strikes me as like you're trying to get an epiphany every 30 seconds. Oh my God, we're going to come to this. Oh, here comes another one. Another bolt of lightning. It's like, I'm too old for that many epiphanies. And I don't want to wait 20 minutes in a row. I'd rather just, how about some more tunes? And typically what you get from older players is a deepening of emotional understanding. But that's not what this music's about.
No.
Right? They're not about creating environments where melody or expressiveness or communication is forefronted. It's this constant, you know, we're going to burst through the multiverse and kick some ass on Saturn with a newspaper ad.
And you know, if you're a young man who's in total possession of all of his technical facility, You can get away with that, but he doesn't, at least on soprano, I don't think he has it anymore. I don't think
at this time, right? And they are not, in other words, I feel like, and maybe at his insistence, but I don't feel like they are. I mean, they're amazing technically. These guys are great. Don't misunderstand me. I don't think they're finding a way to create an environment where the 85-year-old Wayne Shorter can make valid and kind of touching human musical statements. It's like, it just seems kind of driven and clenched. And I'm talking about their playing. I don't know that if you took Wayne out of this, I'd particularly like this much more. I think I'd be less disturbed by the intonation problems, but I don't know that I'd find this a scintillating trio to listen to. I just don't know that they've got whatever the magic is in the best groups that reaches me emotionally. And again, the whole stated ideology of the band is we're searching, we're pressing, we're, you know, but that methodology in itself doesn't make for great music. It can lead to it, but it doesn't guarantee it any more than sitting down playing, you know, Lush Life for the 4 millionth time guarantees it's going to be bad.
Or to put it a different way, they recorded these guys live for these two discs. So why not record them live for 3 months and pick the best cuts? I have the sense that it's like, these are two nights. These are two nights. And this is it. If you're going to do that questing thing, you know, then...
And I don't know why it has to be live.
Sink the money into recording. Yeah, I know. I don't either. Sink the money into recording them for 2 weeks and then pick the best moments.
Well, and I see, my sense is, I cannot prove this, that in a way, where the Vanity Project was trimmed was in the recording. In other words, I don't think disc one sounds like an A-level production to me. It just doesn't. And I'm not going to argue that these live discs sound terrible or something, but they're not, it's not great sound. I mean, it's okay. And as you point out, and this may be, again, Wayne, I don't know that shorter of all people, I mean, if I had to pick one artist on Blue Note that the only albums I'm allowed to keep are one leader's sequence on Blue Note, it'd probably be Wayne.
Sure.
You know, and that's saying a lot, because I mean, there's a lot of music on Blue Note in that classic era I love, and, you know, a lot afterwards. But I think the only album in the acoustic period before he starts turning to soprano, the last three are kind of oddities for me, that I think is at all subpar as Soothsayer. And that's not a bad record. And the rest, I think, are all great to really great. You know, I mean, it's a fucking string of successes.
Right.
It's just kind of amazing how good they are. You know, it's amazing. But those are all studio. You know, I don't know that he's ever, aside from the Plug Nickel.
Well, I like Footprints Live.
Okay, I should go back to that one. Maybe they're a little fresher there. And of course, it's a long time ago now.
Yeah, I know. I mean, that's already 12 or 13 years ago. I mean, my point here isn't to shit on late Wayne Shorter, because this quartet that he plays with, he does some really good things with, but I don't think this is one of them.
Oh, it's funny because album of the year, you know, it's like, okay, what are you talking about? You
know? I know.
It's like, you're on drugs. But there's that automatic thing.
Yeah, there's this critical, oh my God, you know, but it's like, Wayne Shorter at 85 is not Wayne Shorter at 70. He's just not. He's not.
Yeah.
And there's no shame in saying that. This is, hey, Wayne, you built Blue Note. We owe you this. Whatever you want, Wayne. You want a comic book? You've got it.
Right. And I don't think somebody else is telling Wayne you can only record live. I just wish that someone was encouraging him, if they could, to try, maybe, you know, go back in the studio. Maybe.
Isn't Don Was in charge of Blue Note now?
He is, yeah. Don is an interesting figure.
Don is an interesting figure. I read an article that I meant
to. And I'm not like, I don't hate him or something. I mean, I think he's doing some good things to, you know.
Oh, no. A bunch of good things. And he's, you know, I read an article in New York Times about the new sort of roster of folks, some of whom we've actually talked about, Ambrose Akamusare, Robert Glasper, you know, people like that on Blue Note. But there are others in this article that I read about. I'm like, I've never heard of this guy. Holy shit. You know, there's a hot new vibe player that they're heavily promoting, blah, blah, blah. So whether this is, you know, like I said, this feels like Blue Note's victory lap for Wayne Shorter. And okay, fine. You know, we bought it, you know, and Wayne deserves every penny that he gets, he deserves. Tell me that this is as good as any of that earlier stuff, or even as good as Footprints. It's not.
Even the critics writing about it, I will say that, you know, several were certainly not just gushing nonstop. They seemed a little nonplussed, but it's kind of obligatory. It's like this amazing figure. He is important to 21st century music, and he's had this incredible career, and you want to honor him, but yeah, that was not the album of 2018.
Oh, no.
No way in hell.
Baby's on fire, and all the laughing boys are bitching.
Well, you got any pop on your mind?
Yeah, sure. I'll mention a couple of things. You've hooked me up with, in one case, re-hooked me up with the beloved Oingo Boingo.
God help you.
Good for Your Soul. Love that album. And you clued me into Forbidden Boingo, which I have. Yeah. It's a bootleg of Oingo Boingo.
It really is.
It's a lot of fun. It's a wide variety of recording stuff. I'll mention two things that have sort of plopped onto my. I'm going to mention three. So. And get your comments on all of them. I think I've mentioned before, but it recently popped back in the rotation, and I just hadn't listened to it in a long time, but it brings back memories of misspent Midwestern youth. AC/DC's Back in Black.
Oh, yeah.
What a thoroughly repugnant, misogynistic piece of shit that is. And yet, I was reading an article. I read a review by a feminist who basically said, yeah, this is deplorable. And yet, you know, she was a rock journalist saying, you know, this is totally misogynist. It's completely caveman. And
right,
yet,
it's very juvenile, yeah.
And yet, the thudding riffs, it just rocks really, really hard. It's really hard, she said, to hate this with the hatred that it deserved. And she said, basically, the way she kind of excused it was, look, a lot of their fantasies about women really suggest that they're frightened of women, that women who really have the power. And I was like, okay, whatever makes your feminist agenda go there, you know, I'm just going to call this deplorable, completely misogynistic music with an incredible beat. So yeah, I've been listening to it again recently and God, I just like, I'm back at the roller rink in 1979 all night long. Jesus. So that happened. I listened to that again. You must have listened to AC/DC back then as well, if only through the speakers of people you knew in high school.
Well, I picked that album up, I don't know, 10 years ago. And yeah, I mean, it's What Do You Do for Money, Honey? It's explicitly
right.
Misogynist. Some of the other songs
Let's
are just
Put My Love Into You, kind of a rapist's anthem, you know?
It's love. As long as it's expression of love. Client. I mean, I don't think all penetration is perpetration, right? As long as it's consensual, fine.
I do think the least important word in the title of that song is let.
Okay, probably. But yeah, you feel like it's music written for people who have not yet touched a woman.
Yes.
That's
Which is
kind of
so popular when we were in high school.
Absolutely. And they are, you know, they're amazing riffs and they are part of the cultural landscape. But yeah, I listen to it and it's like, yeah, I don't mind. Stupid with a wink can be fun, but I'm not sure there's enough winking that it, yeah.
Nope. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this sold, I think it's like the fifth or sixth highest selling album of all time. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, I was shocked. I read up on it. I was like, oh my God, really? I mean, they are one of the like top five selling acts ever, but this album is like the fifth or sixth highest selling album in history. Who knew? I mean, I had no fucking clue.
Well, they certainly, I mean, there is a purity of purpose about AC/DC,
yep.
Right?
Yep.
It really knows what it wants to be in a way that a lot of groups kind of flounder or, you know, anyway, they knew what they wanted to be.
Here's what we are. And so then also recently back into the rotation is 801 Live. 801 is basically Brian Eno, Phil Manzanera, so Roxy Music players minus Brian Ferry. And it's a live album. And it's actually pretty good. It's got these basic 801 songs, some of which are just Brian Eno songs. But they're kind of tarted up. So stuff like from Another Green World, Somber Reptiles is here. A kind of rockin' out version of You Really Got Me. That is not you don't think of Brian,
right.
You know, Kinks in the same sentence, you know. And a really, you know, lively, frisky version of Tomorrow Never Knows. It's pretty good. I forgot how much I liked this version of Eno who rocked a little bit.
Did I ever send you that awful sounding live bootleg of Eno with what's essentially a bar band playing some of his stuff? And it's, if I haven't, you should hear it.
Is it the live at the BBC? It's like an EP.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's not real long because it tags on bad dubs of his two singles, but they're just much harder edged and kind of more direct.
I have also recently back into the rotation was Live at the BBC, Brian Eno's Live at the BBC, which has Lion Sleeps Tonight, a really tight version of the Fat Lady of Limburg.
Might be it, yeah.
Seven Deadly Fins, third on goal. I mean, I'll come running. I like that a lot. And then last but least, I'll mention a friend for my birthday. I think it was last year, or I don't know when I got this. Maybe it's Christmas. I've been slow to work them into the rotation. Someone got me because I'm a Lloyd Cole fanatic. Was that you? I don't think it was you.
No, I don't think so.
Another friend. Got me a bunch of his stuff off his website that I don't have. So some of this includes his electronic music that I don't have, some of the classic-oriented stuff, and then a couple of his folk singer discs. So I have a disc here that just went into the rotation called, it's Folk Singer Volume 3, called My Austere Demeanor.
Oh, God.
And it's Lloyd. Just Lloyd with a guitar in like a hallway with 10 people, is what it sounds like, playing a variety of songs, mostly his stuff, but some Commotions songs as well. So he plays Four Flights Up, which is interesting. It's kind of an acoustic, these are all acoustic versions. I happen to really like this acoustic version of Are You Ready to Be Heartbroken? I think it's quite
that's a great
good.
Song, yeah.
Such a good song. But there are other songs that he plays that you would not think would work very well as acoustic songs that I kind of like. Rattlesnakes, not a song that I think would do well without the rest of the band, but as an acoustic guitar version, it's a good song as he performs it. He admits he's a guitarist of limited skills. And apparently when he does seriously tour, he brings his son, who's a much better guitarist. Who has got his own gig and band and stuff. But anyway, this is just Lloyd, a guitar, and literally 10 people. I mean, you can hear the individual hand claps at the end of each song.
There you go.
There's no patter. It's just like a straight set. And I like it. I love Lloyd Cole. He can do no wrong as far as I'm concerned. But I do like some of the versions of the songs here without... some of the solo stuff that gets a fair amount of treatment, you can just hear the bare bones now of the song. So like Weeping Wine, Don't Look Back, which has a lovely capoed guitar intro, which here, of course, he can't do because he's just him at one guitar, things like that. And then a couple songs I've never heard of before, Myrtle and Rose, which I liked quite a bit. A song I guess he's recorded elsewhere, but I hadn't heard of them, were called Women's Studies, which is about women's studies. It needs to be heard. I like this album, but then I love everything by Lloyd Cole, but yeah, it takes a little getting used to because his solo efforts are fairly well produced, and he always gets good players in, Richard Quine, Matthew Sweet, etc. He gets good people to play on his albums, and they're often very, very well produced. So hearing him without all the production, just an acoustic guitar in decent voice, but not perfect voice, is kind of revelatory. I enjoy it anyways.
Yeah, I saw him live decades ago.
We saw him live. We saw him at the goddamn Aragon Ballroom together, dude. Don't you remember? Me, you, and Joyce.
Wow. You've got a better memory. I remember seeing him live.
I remember two things in particular about that date. I remember that it was a very good night. He was much taller than I would have thought. I would have thought of him to be a scrawny Scotsman, but he must be over 6 feet. I mean, he's tall. But he closed with, if you recall, he closed with Forest Fire, and it was just fucking epic.
Oh, wow. If you remember his closer, you're way ahead of me, dude.
It was a good night. I mean, that's like the song everyone wants. That's his signature closer song. It's a great, great song. And live, when he has a whole band, it's quite good. And yeah, he closed with it that night. I was reading an interview with him, an interview someone did with him, and they were quoting different. So he's playing a concert with his son, and it was a night where he was going to like take some requests. So he's playing a couple of things, and then everyone just keeps shouting out Forest Fire, and he's like, wait for it.
Ah, yeah. Well, you knew that, yeah. If somebody could be sarcastic live, it'd be Lloyd.
I love that. He's like, wait for it. He's like, we'll get there. Don't worry. So anyway, I like this phase of his career where he's kind of a DIY recording artist doing basically whatever the fuck he wants. He clearly has enough money to do what he wants, and what he wants to do is a variety of things. He's not just a folk singer. He wants to record these ambient...
Right, electronic. I've heard about that. I never heard of them, but yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, I like this. I'm one of those. I'm a completist. I'll just kind of follow him wherever he goes and pony up for the new releases when they come out. But they're all, you know, you have to get them through his website, basically.
Right, which, yeah. He's
the way of musicians for the future, it seems.
Pretty much.
Anyway, yeah. And I'm going to mention a concert coming up here in March. If you actually manage to get out to San Diego, you can see them. Red Barat is playing.
Ah, okay, cool.
That's on the calendar. I'm going for sure.
Cool.
Do you have a shirt? Did you really love one that you feel so groovy in? You don't even mind if it starts to fade. That only makes it nicer still. I love my shirt, I love my shirt. My shirt is so comfortably lovely. I love my shirt.
Yeah, well, Joyce and I spent a couple days in Minneapolis, but where I was able to track down Good for Your Soul by Oingo Boingo was in Hayward, Wisconsin, population 2,000.
Wow.
There's a little bookstore on the main drag, you know, used books and used records, and just a whole bunch of boxes in the upper story. And it was cute because these three, like, 13-year-old boys came in. And I'm flipping through the bins because that's all you can do. I mean, you have to go through every single record. And one looks at me and says, "Do you work here?" And I'm like, "Nope." "Do you know how these are organized?" I'm like, "They aren't." So, tell you what, kiddo, just get looking. And it's just a whole bunch, and often with duplicates of stuff that, like, from the late 60s through, I don't know, mid 80s, of just kind of meat and potatoes rock records and folk records. Just kind of, you know, not bad stuff, but just kind of the stuff an ordinary Joe on the street might have bought. But for some reason, because there really wasn't much of new wave stuff there at all, they did have a copy of this Oingo Boingo, which one felt like an infant had teethed on the cardboard thing. It's very wow. Soft all the way around. And then if you looked at it, looked horribly scuffed. But I thought, well, what the hell? This is kind of a hard record to find. You know, Amazon will say, "Give me $75 or $100. Well, that's ridiculous. But even Discogs, it's $20 or something to get one. This was like $7. But it turned out messy as hell looking, but played pretty well. You know, I was like, I mean, it's not perfect, but...
When you were in Minneapolis, did you go to... if I had known you were going, I would have recommended you go to the Electric Fetus, which is the great used store in Minneapolis.
Well, I absolutely did, actually. I went a couple places. Good. I went to Cheapo Records, which has moved, and it's kind of a pain. Most of the stuff there is crap. Not all of it, but so much. That's where I got the Oingo Boingo CDR that I didn't know was, you know, the CDR. And a couple other things that, you know, were fine, but it's really depressing. They'll have, like, new issues from Europe of these kind of bootleg LPs. I'm like, why is this stuff even here? What's the point? And then Electric Fetus is like less than half a mile from the art museum, which is very, very good.
Yeah.
And so I walk down there, and they actually have a pretty impressive new selection.
They do.
Had, you know, like the Joe Henderson's Art of the Tenor 2, but I'm like, well, probably shouldn't spend $32 on this right now.
Right.
But, you know, they had a couple other things. And, you know, I looked around there and I found a couple of things. I got a couple ECM. ECM's been reissuing stuff, but both of them, the personnel looked promising. And I listened to it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, this is why it's easy to dislike ECM if you don't pick the highlights. They're both way too echoey and wandery. You know, they're just, it's funny because some of those albums I really kicked me on my butt and I really love. And the ones I got didn't. But, you know, I was real happy to find Good for Your Soul. That was my favorite Oingo Boingo album. I'm still kind of looking around for Only a Lad, which I've never heard, which was their first long player. But otherwise, I've got a pretty complete collection at this point.
You have all the Oingo you need.
That's right. I mean, they boingoed a lot longer, but once they left Atlantic, or A&M rather, it just wasn't the same. And then I came up with a copy of Donovan's Brabajaggle. It's very hard to say the title. Donovan's Brabajaggle. I talked about this like a year and a half ago in Sweden. They were making some kind of audiophile reissue of this album. I'm like, what the hell is this? And so I listened to it a couple times on streaming, and this LP copy looked much cleaner than Oingo Boingo and turned out to be noisier, but it's just 30 minutes of Donovan nonsense, including a song about a 14-year-old girl that I really tempted to like go in and digitally edit and just say Age of Consent. Because it is just like, what the fuck are you talking? But what? No, no, that's bad, Donovan. No, that's that was wrong in the 60s. It's wrong now. Anyway, but there's some really cool tracks on it. And so the live thing I did see was in Minneapolis with Joyce. We went to the Dakota, the jazz club downtown, which is, I think, in a building owned by Target. So it's like a jazz club, but in a downtown, I don't want to say skyscraper, but, you know, large building that you kind of go in the lobby and then it's kind of buried in there. Unfortunately, I got good seats to see Joey DeFrancesco. Have you ever?
Oh, yes. And?
You know, I was way too close. Don't get too close to the Joe. You know, he's unbelievably fucking talented. So he plays organ. He's got a synth on top of that. He also plays more than respectable trumpet. And I known about that. And then the motherfucker pulled out a tenor saxophone and played a pretty technically demanding solo on that. Meanwhile, the tenor saxophone player in his band also plays string bass. And the drummer just played drums because I guess he didn't want to compete. But it's like, holy fuck. I mean, these guys are incredibly talented, but they're kind of annoying. So it's like, ugh. The tenor player he had effects pedals on his saxophone, so at times it was a very much a metal mouthpiece kind of tenor player. Very powerful, very loud, a little bit piercing. You know, again, technically amazing. And he split his tone, and of course the second one coming through the speakers is just highly distorted, and I'm like, I'm losing the hearing in my right ear. I don't want to lose the hearing. I love music. Stop, Joey, stop. But it's a well-run club. I was hoping, you know, Joey, I kind of felt like he's worked with Van Morrison. His latest album had titles that kind of lean towards the spiritual dimension. So I thought, you know, maybe he's getting spacier. Maybe this is going to be a mind trip or more introspective. And it was mainly meat and potatoes, high velocity, very loud, blues burning. You know, just real, just, you know, the old fashioned. It's like, you know, Jimmy Smith is back and he's in the body of a very talented, obese white guy. So he didn't get angry at me, even though I think I was making grumpy faces occasionally. So that worked out. And, you know, it's a well set up club. It's well run. I'd go back again if I got a chance. The reason I picked him was we had something to do Saturday night. I was looking for something Friday. It's like, oh, I'd like to see the Dakota. I've never been there. Maybe Joey will surprise me, but he didn't. I mean, again, amazing human being. I mean, my God, the guy is just, I don't think I've ever seen anybody that could play three instruments at that level, but I just, wow. I think it reminded me of, you know, Miles Davis. Why was he a genius? Or Duke Ellington, whoever, you know, the balance of the band that do, you know, think of Dave Brubeck with Paul Desmond. I mean, those guys are very different, right? You know, 1 pound, one floats. Joey had 3 pounders. You know, it's like, I need a floater here. Just anybody. Is there a flautist in the house? Where is Herbie Mann when you need him? Because it is. It's like, okay, you just like nailed my head to the wall with a bunch of 16th notes. Now what's the tenor player going to do? Oh, the same thing. And now the drummer's going to solo. Is he going to do some kind of minimalist Palmodian thing? No, he's not. He's great. He's going to play a lot more notes. But I recommend going to the Dakota. It's right downtown. It's pretty cool. The whole neighborhood there is just awesome.
Yeah, it's my year in Iowa, I couldn't get to Minneapolis often enough. It's a great town. Minneapolis-St. Paul it's got a great music scene. It's got a really world-class theater, the Guthrie. It's got a shit ton of stuff going for it. I love going there. I love that place. So.
Yeah, we went to the Guthrie and saw a play about sandwiches. It was pretty funny, pretty well done. But it was literally about making sandwiches. And it was like, the implication was maybe it was kind of a riff on No Exit. And maybe the woman that employed these felons to make sandwiches was aligned with Satan. They didn't really press it. You know, anyway, it was cute. And that concludes episode 174 of the Jazz Bastard Podcast. As usual, you can reach us at pat@jazzbastard.com or mike@jazzbastard.com. Or if you like, drop us a line on Facebook, or look me up on All About Jazz. The podcast can be downloaded from www.jazzbastard.com, from Stitcher, from Mixcloud, from Apple Podcasts, and can be streamed at All About Jazz. Tune in next time as we talk about works by and adjacent to Frank Zappa, all at a listener suggestion. We're going to look at a couple albums by Frank himself, and we're going to look at albums by Jean-Luc Ponty and Ed Palermo. Till then, take care.